10 Palestinians killed in one day. Two were killed the day before. 30 killed so far this year, and only 26 days have passed in the month of January. Such is the state of affairs of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. And when it comes to reaction from the international community, it appears that there isn't enough, even though Palestinian lives are being extinguished. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why the issue of Palestine is not given the attention that it rightfully deserves, especially when it comes to an extreme right-wing cabinet that is out to apparently erase Palestinians off the Palestinian territory. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Leif Maruf, activist and political commentator, joins us from Beirut. Also joining us is Zakir Ahmad Mayat, an attorney, activist, and political analyst who joins us from Johannesburg.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome. Leif Maruf, I'll start with you. Obviously, this is a shocking and terrible and sad day, to say the least. I'm not keen to use adjectives in an opening question, but how else can you look at the massacre that has taken place in one single day where 10 Palestinians have been killed? There are reports that there could be more overall to have died in the occupied territories, but we have 10 so far for what has happened. I'm not too sure what else to say, but I can say even more that the killing included 6 children and an elderly woman. What's your reaction to what has occurred, first of all?
My reaction is that this comes less than a day and a half from Netanyahu visiting Jordan and meeting with the king of Jordan, which is at the moment as a country boiling over for because of the crash of the economy and because of their brethren being killed in the West Bank of Palestine. So the question comes now is this what Netanyahu delivered? What did he deliver to the king of Jordan for him to be able to do such a thing less than a day and a half from his visit to that country? The crimes of the Zionists will continue in Palestine until the Palestinians are able to defeat their occupiers, and we need more resistance, and Jenin is showing the way forward to the Palestinian people. Today was a heroic day for Jenin. It is a sad day, of course, for all the innocence that was lost against the occupier, fighting against the occupier, but it is also a proud day for Palestine, where the Zionists were not able to go into the heart of Jenin because of the first resistance.
We always need to watch out for the, not watch out, but mention and highlight, Zakir Ahmad, the narrative and how the media twists the way that it's being reported. And I'm taking just one example here, where it says 9 Palestinians have been killed during an Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank, the deadliest in years. So far, sounds okay. But then it says Palestinian officials say. So it's kind of throwing that from the viewpoint of Palestinians reporting it. And then it says a woman aged 60 was reported among the dead in the flashpoint town of Jenin. And then it says the Israeli military said its troops went in to arrest, and it calls them Islamic Jihad militants who were planning major attacks. Now, we know these are fighters, and then it talks about an event that has not even taken place. How can that even justify logic when they go and then as a result, 10 have been killed for what? For maybe attacks that may have been planned?
The narrative is particularly important within the sphere of global attention. It's very hard for Israel to justify its actions when it has such a right-wing government. Individuals such as Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir, both of them are extreme right-wing, so severe in their viewpoints that even the Americans were concerned about the election of this government. Therefore, they have to use every trick in the book to try and justify these actions. These actions, however, are not just isolated to pure Israeli brutality. There's a system behind this. There's a strategic objective behind this, and one that has not been spoken about is what is the reason for this massive escalation that you spoke about at the very introduction of this program. This is a systematic program to reestablish the Palestinian Authority. This is not something that I've come up with. It's something that's very clear from Israeli think tanks such as the JISS, the Jerusalem Institute for Security Studies, as well as the Israeli Institute for National Security Studies, INSS. Both of them are talking about the restoration of the monopoly of violence to the Palestinian Authority. Hence, you see these violent incursions into the cities in occupied Palestine. So what you have here is the Israeli regime trying to reestablish their collaborators and the power of their collaborators, and they are prepared to massacre the innocent as they do so and spin a false narrative within the media. This is a full campaign. We cannot just look at it in isolation, and we must understand the strategic objectives. I believe that we are in a very dangerous fork right now, considering the military exercises that are taking place within Israel, and that's also a possibility that we must explore perhaps later in the show.
Okay, so if I was to understand you correctly, you're saying that in order for the PA and its authority to be reestablished, meaning that it has lost it, but for it to be reestablished in the occupied territories, Israel has committed what it has done, and then in that way, the PA, in collaboration with Israel, can then reestablish its authority and therefore maintain some kind of control over the Palestinians. Is that correct in how I understood what you said?
That is precisely correct. This is in a document that was issued today. It was an article that was written by the professor of the JISS, Professor Ephraim Inbar. He said it today. He said that we are seeing now a Lebanization of the West Bank, a proliferation of military movements that is undermining and could possibly collapse the Palestinian Authority, and therefore Israel needs to step in. He was speaking specifically about the situation within the West Bank. This goes further in the INSS, where they are talking about, and this links to what my fellow panelist has just said, what was discussed with the King of Jordan, the Hashemite Kingdom. In the INSS report, it says with the collapse of Abbas, it's a 100-page report, came out in December of last year. The title was The Day After Abbas. They talk about the Hashemite Kingdom actually participating in taking over part of the responsibilities in the West Bank. We are at a very serious precipice, and what we are seeing now is just the front of it, the massacres of the Palestinians, the strategy behind it.
All right, so Leith Maruf, what do you think about what our guest there has said? Do you agree with him, first of all? I mean, we're talking also, I should mention that the PA has made an announcement just in the past hour or so that it's not going to continue its security cooperation with Israel, which many ask, why does it even cooperate with Israel when it comes to security on Palestinians when so many are getting killed?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't believe what Abbas is saying or the Palestinian Authority right now about cutting the security coordination with the Zionist occupiers until we see it in action. My colleague here is exactly connecting the same process. We have two collaborating regimes, the Palestinian Authority and the Jordanian Hashemite elite, who are courting Netanyahu right now to save their own positions. Because remember, if actually Ben-Gvir and the extreme Zionists, if there's such a thing that is not an extreme Zionist, achieve stripping the Aqsa Mosque from the Hashemite, patronage, it will mean the end of Hashemite existence, because the only reason the Hashemites exist in Islamic tradition and have any royal status is to be custodians of the holy sites. They've already lost Mecca and Medina to Al Saud, and this is the last thing that keeps them in any shape or form in a royal status. So here we have both the Palestinian Authority and the Hashemites working with the Netanyahu regime to try to save the apparatuses of control within the West Bank as the resistance increases. And at the same time, we see that actually today, for instance, much of the resistance that happened included people that are members of the armed wings of the PLO, Fatah specifically, along with the Hamas and Islamic Jihad. So it means that what we see is a collapse of the Fatah apparatus. Beyond the collapse of the Palestinian Authority that we will witness very shortly, we are seeing also the collapse of Fatah and maybe eventually its control of the PLO.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, so we're looking at two different issues since we're talking about what you both have presented. One is the issue of Jordan and its custodianship of Al-Aqsa in terms of its status there. And then the other, we're talking about the PA and in terms of its authority. So my question, first of all, Zakir Ahmed comes, and I think it's a logical one, is why should this, on the PA side and the PA issue, why should that come at the cost of losing Palestinian lives? Couldn't there be another way of approaching the PA and its, I guess, control over Palestine?
It's the same approach that the apartheid regime used here in South Africa to establish its control. They created Bantustans, various different homelands, created military forces trained, funded, and supported by the apartheid regime, the enforcers within this region. It was movements such as APLA, the armed movement of the PAC, and Mkhonto weSizwe, the armed movement of the ANC, that fought against this. And similarly, we are seeing the same situation playing out within Palestine. What has happened now is that the collaborators are panicking. They have now reached out to the illegitimate donor, Israel, and said, please come and help us. So what is happening now is that what you are seeing is the sacrificing of the Palestinian people to ensure that certain corrupt collaborators remain in power, and this is bound to fail. Surely they have noticed that in South Africa it failed. Surely it's going to fail within Palestine. This indicates to us that we should not entertain on any of our resistance platforms, any of our solidarity platforms, representatives of the Palestinian Authority. They are collaborators in South Africa. If we had to entertain individuals who had cooperated with the security branch or any other form of security apparatus of the apartheid state, surely they would have been necklaced. We should not allow this. We need to expose these individuals who are sacrificing the Palestinian people for who they are, your collaborators that don't care about the Palestinians.
On the issue of Jordan, thank you for that. On the issue of Jordan now, let's move on to that, Laith Maruf. And I really thank you for bringing this up, because this kind of went outside of the realm of the program in terms of the certain topics that you wanted to cover. But this is something that you now brought up, and of course I am scrambling to get some information on this. But yet I do see here that on the 24th, Netanyahu actually had paid a surprise visit to Jordan, and I think you mentioned that, and he said that he vowed to uphold the Al-Aqsa status. Now, you're saying that if that doesn't happen, that Jordan would lose its Hashemite, I guess, rule, in a sense, if I, again, understood you correctly. Now, what are we looking at if that doesn't happen with this extreme? And as you said, how extreme can it be? But you're looking at the characters of this extreme cabinet. Do you think they're going to let go of Al-Assad? Because all looks of it, with the way they're moving and plowing ahead, they're breaking all barriers, it seems like. And Al-Assad obviously is going to be one of them under the watch of Gavir in terms of either the prayer restrictions that are going to probably get more, and, of course, not allowing even Palestinians into the mosque, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, look, this today's activities and attacks on Jenin come just, a day and a half, 2 days after Smotril became the Minister of Internal, took the actual full position. So now we see a direct a result of having an extremist settler, Kahanist, in charge of what they call internal security and the apparatus that, of security in the West Bank. This is the results of it. So this action wouldn't have happened had Netanyahu not got the okay, both from the Palestinian Authority and the King of Jordan, to attack now after the whole population is on edge in both Palestine and Jordan. And we can see an agreement happening there on this actions. Luckily, it seems like the Palestinian, resistance movements in Jenin and Nablus and so forth have matured to a point where they can resist and successfully repel an invasion into the city. This means that even if the Palestinian Authority wants to take back Jenin, it cannot take back Jenin even with a direct Israeli involvement, as we saw today, without a massacre larger than the one that happened in 2002, which means there will be a war in all across Palestine. If this continues, this pressure, we're already at the edge today of a return to direct military, full battle across all of historic Palestine, like happened last year.
Well, okay, so what's going to make that not happen, Zakir Ahmad? Do you think that Israel is going to stop? I mean, we're looking at really from April of last year, continuously increasing the raids, and now for the past months, and looking at the 26 days, and today being the culmination of what we're looking at, which is about 10 deaths so far, which is one of the worst. I mean, do you think that Israel is going to stop there? And if you say yes, or if you say no, that is, then that means, would that scenario that our guest in Beirut said occur, where you're going to see a war that's going to pretty much engulf all of occupied Palestine?
I concur with the panelist from Beirut. He's 100% correct. What we see is a direct path to a massive escalation. As I referred previously to the 100-page memorandum that was issued by INSS in December of last year, the end part when they said that if the Palestinian Authority collapses, what they would be forced to do would be to occupy the entire West Bank. Yes, we know the legal status is occupied, but that means a full deployment of military throughout the West Bank, putting permanent curfews, etc. This would lead to an inevitable escalation. We know the Joint Operations Room has already issued a statement. There was an emergency meeting this evening of the various factions, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and many other smaller factions. Now, this comes at, there's another strategic point that's taking place. There's been numerous conferences over the last 2 months, and particular effort has been placed in this last month to discuss the reservist failure within Israel, meaning that they are short of reservists should they enter into a multi-front war. And this has been admitted by Major General Gadi Eisenkot and many of the other senior echelons of the Israeli military. However, in this period of time, we have a very strategic change. We have 6,400 U.S. troops, approximately 100 U.S. aircraft. There's one strike carrier group of the U.S. Navy, so that means aircraft carrier and supporting military infrastructure, 6 ships. These are huge amounts of military equipment. These are force multipliers. Therefore, I think that the Israelis are taking the opportunity now to try and strike the West Bank, try and stabilize their collaborator, and to ensure that the restoration is successful. Should they fail, and they are aware of this, this might lead to a large-scale war, a regional war, and now they have the United States there as a force multiplier. I don't think we can look at these elements as coincidental, and we cannot look at their own military literature as coincidental. It paints a very bleak picture, and I think that it is quite dangerous, and I do believe that the resistance axis is ready, Al-Muqawam al-Islamiyah is ready for engagement, and it is a continuation of Saif al-Quds, in my opinion. It's going to spell the end of Israel should this continue in this trajectory with these lunatics such as Etamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich.
Okay, so this is very interesting. If we're going to go with that thesis or that the facts that our guest there in Johannesburg said there, Laith Maruf, let's say that projection comes true, or that speculation does indeed come true. It's not as if Israel has been dealing with Palestinians and the resistance fighters and Palestinians in general who are fighting back. They're also dealing with their own homegrown problem of Israelis who want this cabinet to go. I mean, there's even a movement that's out that calls for 10,000 Israelis at a minimum to move out of Israel until they get the message. If you have that type of a military activity happen, couldn't that backfire on Israel itself and therefore create a huge headache for themselves that may even break them apart?
Yes, and of course, they also have no choice but to do this, because the Western Empire ruled from D.C. is collapsing, and because their own internal issues are collapsing from within, they have no choice but to instigate external wars in hopes of slowing down this collapse. So right now, we are just like in the war in Ukraine, we're getting to a points of no return or closing down of options that the players have. The Israelis are running out of options. And, you know, a reminder to our listeners, the American military, as our guests from Johannesburg just reminded, is stationed right now there and have been conducting the largest exercise in the history of the Zionist colony with the American military forces, throwing bunker buster, mother of all bombs in the Naqab pristine ecology of the Naqab desert in threats to bomb the nuclear facilities of Iran and the rest of, you know, attacking the rest of the axis of resistance if they dare. And so for this attack on Jenin to happen right now, it is definitely the Israelis feel safe with the backing of the Americans right there conducting that activity. Imagine right now if an actual armed resistance starts throwing missiles from Gaza and or multiple attacks happen in the West Bank and a full-out war happens and the Palestinians ask for the backing of the resistance axis in Lebanon, Syria, and Iran. This is going to change the reality. So the Israelis are taking advantage of this moment on multiple levels.
All right. So I got one question to ask. It's the last question. Isn't this another, just this whole scenarios and elements that we covered, a prime example of how this Palestinian issue has been tossed down, a can that's been tossed down the road from one U.S. president to another, to have reached what we're looking at based on our conversation in this program to the boiling point that it needs to be addressed? Or are we beyond that? Less than a minute, please. Zakir Ahmed.
We're definitely beyond that. I think we're far too far gone on this issue. The situation is that it's like the apartheid regime. It needs to come to an end. Even the human rights organizations acknowledge this. And the only way that you can dismantle the state, unlike the way I see it in South Africa, was that there has to be a war, and this is what Israel recognizes, and that's what we could be heading for. However, they're underestimating the power of Al-Muqawam al-Islamiyah, the resistance faction, and our full support there. I think the world's support is behind the Palestinians.
Thank you for that. We're going to end it there. We do appreciate it. It was a fascinating conversation. Zakir Ahmed Mayat, attorney, activist, and political analyst from Johannesburg, and Leith Maruf, thank you for your contribution, activist and political commentator from Beirut. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tabway and the team. It's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll try to have a look at the commentary of Chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode. Dear listeners, now let's listen to 151st and 2nd verses of Chapter Shu'ara.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
ولا تطيعوا أمر المسرفين.
And do not obey the order of the transgressors.
الذين يفسدون في الأرض ولا يصلحون.
Who cause corruption in the land and do not amend.
So the verse says, ولا تطيعوا أمر المسرفين. And the next one, الَّذِينَ يُفْسِدُونَ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَلَا يُسْلِحُونَ. And do not obey the bidding of the extravagant, those who make mischief in the earth and amend not, وَلَا يُسْلِحُونَ. So these are how the words of their prophet continued. فَاتَّقُوا اللَّهُ أَطِيعُونَ. Then be in awe of Allah and obey me, after he criticized them. And he continues, وَلَا تُطِيعُوا أَمْرَ الْمُسْرِفِينَ. Do not obey the bidding of the extravagant. الَّذِينَ يُفْسِدُونَ فِي الْأَرْضِ. He tries to explain who truly these musrifin are, these extravagant ones. الَّذِينَ يُفْسِدُونَ فِي الْأَرْضِ. Those who make mischief on the earth. وَلَا يُسْلِحُونَ. They do not rectify. They amend not. Of course, we know that extravagance is the same as exceeding the limits of law. Different laws, law of creation, law of religion. And this is also clear for all that in a correct system, any exceeding the limit causes corruption and destruction for other parts. In other words, the origin of corruption is extravagance. And the consequence of extravagance is mischief. Of course, it should be noted that extravagance has a pretty vast meaning. Sometimes it is used in simple issues like eating and drinking. Sometimes it is in judgment and judiciary arbitration, which leads to falsehood. And sometimes it is in one's beliefs, which leads to doubt and skepticism, as it is in chapter Ghafir, where the words Musrif and Murtab have come together. Sometimes it has also been used in the sense of self-superiority, arrogance, and exploitation, as it is used in chapter Dukhan, where the Holy Quran says about Pharaoh, "Surely he was haughty and of the extravagant." And finally, sometimes it has been applied to any sin and fault, as it is used in chapter Zumar, where the Holy Quran says, "Oh, my servants, who have acted extravagantly against their own selves, do not despair of the mercy of Allah. Surely Allah forgives the faults altogether. Surely He is the forgiving, the merciful." لا تقنطوا من رحمة الله إن الله يغفر الذنوب جميعا. So, this is the importance of the meaning of extravagance and its different implications. على مر الزمان تألقا
وأضاء للدنيا طريقا. We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qum.
So we explained the meaning of extravagance. Now, the verse says, "La tuti'u amra al-musrifin." Let's have a look at this verse alone. So, in the previous verses, as you were with us, we had a look at what the Prophet Saleh told them. At the end, he said, فَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ وَأَطِيعُونَ. Now you need to obey me. You need to be in awe of Allah and obey me. And now he says, وَلَا تُطِيعُوا أَمْرَ الْمُسْرِفِينَ. These two things must be together. Loving someone in accordance with negating the others. This is exactly as the concept of belief in the Almighty Allah and negating belief in any other thing. La ilaha illallah. Both together. So you need to ati'un, obey me, and at the same time, la tuti'u amra al-musrifin. So anyway, the one who is from among the extravagant ones is not qualified to lead one country or one nation or society, and that's why their prophet tells them, لا تطيعوا أمر المسرفين. These people are not qualified to be your leaders. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. There are other points to be discussed regarding these two verses, which we will, God willing, mention in the next episodes. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
I'm heading with humanitarian aid workers to drop off desperately needed supplies to civilians on the outskirts of Donetsk. Recently, fighting has become fierce as Russia seeks to advance across much of Donbass. A Russian tank fires at Ukrainian positions. As we drive, the boom of incoming not far off, we see the smoke rising from amongst the trees. A few moments later, a Russian artillery unit emerges from the site of the strike. They were hit. We arrive at the arranged gathering site to drop off the supplies. These people live only hundreds of meters from the front and spend most of their time cowering in their apartments.
Now, while I have reported on dozens of the Ukrainian terror strikes in the center of Donetsk, where there are no discernible military targets, bus stations, schools, markets, here we're so close to the front line that the civilians who live here run the extreme risk of getting hit by indirect Ukrainian fire. You can hear the constant incoming and outgoing around these areas. The people here tell me that just yesterday a music school was hit, killing a local man.
Tatiana Montion is a renowned Ukrainian lawyer, today helping to deliver aid.
Where they have to live. You can imagine how many people here. It's about 100,000 people all around the front line. How is it possible to move these people somewhere in safe place? It's impossible, absolutely impossible. So we do what we do. They have no shops, they have no transport, they have no possibility to feed themselves, so we help them.
Tatiana fled Kiev to Donbass 2 years ago, fearing arrest for her outspoken criticism of the Ukrainian government.
Everybody here understands that it's United States made all this trash to weaken European economy, to crash European economy, to force European industry to move to United States. Everybody here understands it. But why not European people? Ordinary people, of course, because I am sure that European top elite understands it best of all. But they're too corrupt to tell about it to their peoples.
On our way to the next drop-off, we're stopped by Russian soldiers. They tell us not to carry on the same road. We get out of the car to assess our options. There is heavy fire nearby. That's the reality across much of Donbass. Back in the car, massive incoming close by, and we're left no choice but to drive fast. In this desolate post-apocalyptic wasteland, it's artillery doing most of the killing. At the next drop-off, this woman tells me her mother is dying on the other side of the front. so she can't be with her in her final days. She breaks down in tears, saying she wants both sides to negotiate a peace. With peace negotiations further away than ever, both Russia and NATO seem determined to end this war with brute force. For the civilians trapped along either side of the battle lines, survival is a daily chore. Many won't see the end of the war. Many won't see the end of this week. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Celebrating January 26th, best known as Australia Day, has become increasingly controversial in recent years, with people holding rallies on this day to highlight the historical plight of Aboriginals. Many Indigenous Australians who traced their lineage on the continent back 50,000 years regard it as Invasion Day. Tens of thousands of protesters lined up in Sydney, while thousands more gathered in Melbourne, Canberra, and other cities, saying the day marks the beginning of colonial oppression and genocide.
Nobody's got the right to celebrate genocide. That's it. This is ground zero, genocide. Ground zero happened here on 26th of January, 1788. Nobody should be celebrating. It's not an event to celebrate.
The government has designated January 26th as National Day, which marks the anniversary of the 1788 arrival of the first fleet of British ships in Port Jackson. But protesters believe the government is still trying to gloss over the scale of British colonizers' crimes against Native Australians.
I think most white Australians would not celebrate this day at all if they knew exactly that level of depression and deep sadness.
There are several accounts of how colonizers wiped out Indigenous communities in Australia through brutal and heart-wrenching repression. Emily Caroline Cray, a young settler traveling through northwest Queensland in 1883, recounts some of the British colonizers' horrendous crimes in her personal diary.
The station owner has 40 pairs of blacks' ears nailed around the walls collected during raiding parties after the loss of many cattle speared by the blacks.
Aboriginal people remain the most disadvantaged Australians, with higher rates of poverty, health issues and imprisonment than any other community. Now more than 2.5 centuries later, they're still struggling to find their feet in a white-dominated society. Australia's Prime Minister is planning to hold a referendum in March on recognizing around 4% Indigenous people in the Constitution. But repeated calls to abolish the controversial National Day have fell on deaf ear, as the government remains adamant to celebrate what many call the anniversary of Australia's colonization.
Due to a surge in respiratory infections, hospital emergency departments in many EU countries are currently being overwhelmed. Hundreds of drugs to treat winter-related illnesses are unavailable in most of the bloc's 27 nations. The crisis has been raised in the European Parliament.
We debate again about shortage of different medicines, most notably antibiotics. This debate is the proof that the European Commission is not the solution, but the cause of many problems all across Europe.
EU inflation is very high because of energy sanctions against Russia. The production of drugs in the bloc has slumped because of rising manufacturing costs associated with inflation. China is a major supplier, but relations between Brussels and Beijing have deteriorated.
We are witnessing public health systems across the EU become overwhelmed and exhausted as a result of the recent surge of COVID-19, flu, and RSV patients.
Critics say as a result of following US foreign policy, EU leaders have created a new health crisis by jeopardising global supply chains. A growing number of EU health workers are forced to stay at home after becoming ill themselves.
The workers in the field are not getting to work. They are perhaps at work and not being productive sufficiently or not contributing well. And that affects the economy at the same time.
Experts say standards in health services across the EU vary greatly. Statistics show a person in intensive care with COVID-19 in Luxembourg has a 65% chance of survival. In fellow EU nation Romania, it's just 25%. There are warnings the current health emergency could get even worse.
the COVID virus is still circulating within Europe. And I wanted to share with you that we are closely monitoring the situation in China and, of course, in the United States, where a new Omicron subvariant has appeared.
It was left to Russia to fly in emergency medical equipment to Italy when COVID-19 first struck Europe. It's the type of cooperation we are unlikely to see again anytime soon. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For more than 120 years, the steelworks have dotted the Scunthorpe skyline. Its glory days when tens of thousands of people worked here are long gone. And these are anxious times for the 4,000 or so staff on shift and tens of thousands in the supply chain. British Steel is the UK's second largest steel manufacturer after India-owned Tata Group, ranking 25th worldwide and 8th in Europe. However, it's been troubled for decades. In 2019, the uncertainty over Brexit pushed it to bankruptcy. Since then, it's had three owners, most recently China's Jingye Group, which is asking the British government for hundreds of millions of dollars to go green and to keep its doors open.
A long tail to it, this story of the decline of the British steel industry. And you can take it all the way back to after the Second World War, where there was a lack of real investment going in, and the result being not being very competitive, and other emerging nations, now very successful nations, like, for example, Korea and obviously China, now producing steel at a cheaper price, more efficiently, and the UK was left behind.
Soaring energy prices fueled by the UK-backed war in Ukraine, carbon taxes and lost markets are only some of the reasons that have added to the already tough trading conditions. The $370 million rescue package from the government is to help British Steel replace its energy-intensive coal-burning blast furnaces with electric alternatives. Only a short while after Number 10 gave the green light for a new coal mine near Scotland.
Sadly, we're going to be seeing over the next few years more contradictory issues when it comes to what's green, what's environmentally acceptable and what is not. And then put that against actually the practical issues about the difficulties in obtaining power, the cost of power, and a lot of that you could say put down to the war in Ukraine. But it's a global issue, this one, which is going to mean that politicians will be, I'm afraid, well, whether it's actually greenwash or pure green, is going to be interesting to see actually what comes out.
It also comes a few days after British Volt, a car battery gigafactory, touted as a Brexit success story, declared bankruptcy.
British Steel underpins essential sectors in the UK economy, from aerospace to transport to construction. And the unions, such as GMB, are saying that the government handout will do little for the long-term future of an industry that's lurching from one crisis to another. Said Purza, Scunthorpe.
Hundreds of protesters took to the streets of the Pakistani capital Islamabad to denounce the desecration of Quran in Sweden.
The blasphemous act was carried out by a hardline Swedish politician on Saturday. He was guarded by police forces when he set fire to a copy of the Holy Quran in Stockholm.
Holding banners and placards with anti-West slogans, the protesters, including religious scholars, traders, and rights activists, demanded the UN to slam the incident.
We are here to condemn in the strongest possible terms the vile attack on our holy book. Permitting this anti-Islam act, which targets Muslims and insults our sacred values on the grounds of freedom of expression, is entirely unacceptable.
Islam is a religion of peace, and we believe in the need to respect all beliefs. These principles must be supported by all. The West has been trying to hurt the feelings of Muslims by desecrating our Prophet as well as our holy book Quran in the recent past. This should be stopped now.
Sweden is facing the outrage of Muslim countries including Iran, Turkey, Pakistan, Yemen, and Saudi Arabia, in which people denounced the Scandinavian nation for the incident. The Pakistani protesters called it a senseless and provocative Islamophobic act that hurts the religious sentiments of over 1.5 billion Muslims across the globe.
We will not accept the discretion of our religious beliefs. Such actions are not covered under any legitimate expression of the right to freedom of speech or opinion. The West is trying to create anarchy in the Islamic world by hurting their religious beliefs, which is condemnable and unacceptable.
Similar protest demonstrations were also held in major cities and towns of Pakistan.
Pakistan has called on the international community to take measures against Islamophobia and sacrilegious acts against Muslim sanctities. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Ukrainian officials took part in a meeting of EU foreign affairs ministers on Monday via video link. An additional €500 million military aid package for Kiev was confirmed, but the EU is at pains to point out that's just a drop in the ocean compared to what the bloc has already provided since last March.
Keep in mind the figure of $49 billion is the total amount of support to Ukraine, military, financial, economic and humanitarian.
Just a few days ago in the European Parliament, the strategy was condemned.
It's militarism that's driving a dramatic rise in geopolitical tensions, drastically undermining our security. And you'd think that the Ukraine war would have shocked us out of this approach, but no.
Workers have taken to the streets of Brussels to demand peace negotiations.
We need to stop this war because it's affecting our workers, and our workers have already been affected with prices because of the COVID situation.
EU foreign ministers adopted a fresh round of sanctions against Iran on Monday over alleged human rights abuses. The grounds for such sanctions are vehemently rejected by Tehran. Critics say the West's policy towards Russia and Iran is being driven by Washington. Moscow and Tehran control the largest energy reserves in the world. Analysts say the EU's access to these markets is being hampered due to influence from the United States, and ultimately it is ordinary citizens who are paying the price. Also on Monday, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtaya updated EU foreign ministers on the appalling situation in the occupied territories. There was absolutely no discussion on the EU side regarding possible sanctions against Israel. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The United States suffered its worst mass shooting in nearly a year when a gunman killed 10 and wounded 10 others in California. In the nation's third largest city of Chicago, at least 30 people were shot and 7 killed over the weekend, illustrating how routine gun violence has become across the country. The California gunman showed symptoms of paranoia and mental illness, but for the last 40 years, liberal economic measures have gutted not only health services, but sent jobs overseas, eliminated anti-poverty measures, and fostered a climate of perpetual instability and insecurity.
People feel like it is every person for themselves. And for some people, then the answer to that is going to be, yeah, it's worth the risk. It's worth the, you know, it's worth taking the steps to engage in, you know, I don't know, theft, carjackings, breaking into homes, you know, and ultimately, you know, you're going to have certain situations with that will create, you know, instances of gun violence and murder.
Last year saw almost double the number of mass shootings compared with just 4 years ago. In 2022, death rates from firearms reached their highest level in 3 decades. For many big city mayors, even Democratic ones, more cops is the answer. However, anti-police sentiment has exploded, most recently at a protest in Atlanta against yet another killing by police, and many say more militarism just isn't the solution.
Real community safety measures, which does not mean more police within the neighborhoods, but actually means going through building real community bases of support that lean in the direction of violence prevention, but ultimately that can't be separated out from the real needs, you know, of housing, healthcare, education that working people face on the daily.
Following the California massacre, a congressman said that mass shootings are a uniquely American experience. With the termination of many coronavirus-era assistance programs
and another recession on the horizon, few expect that such experiences will decrease. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago. United States President Joe Biden has just reached the halfway mark of his term, and perhaps the best word to sum up the past 2 years is a new phrase, polycrisis, which is defined as the simultaneous creation of several catastrophic events. Most of them started with foreign policy. Biden totally backtracked on his promise to re-enter the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy agreement, and then charged into exacerbating the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Sanctions on Russia have backfired so badly that the average family has lost over a month's salary since Biden took office, or $7,400. Biden came to power with total control of Congress, thanks to big campaign promises of rebuilding after the devastation of the coronavirus lockdowns.
The Build Back Better plan that was supposed to give you all these, you know, workers' rights, it was supposed to, like, you know, put so much money into infrastructure, it was supposed to improve the education system. Barely any part of the Build Back Better plan made it past legislation.
Biden's approval rating is currently the lowest of his presidency at just 40%. The Democrats lost control of the lower House of Representatives in the midterm elections due to widespread disillusionment. The country now faces 2 years of congressional dysfunction, and many wonder if the progressive spirit of 2020 can be recaptured.
Every time Republicans have control, they will use whatever power they can, little or a lot, to get what they want passed. Whenever Democrats are in charge, whatever the Republicans left them, they'll cling on to it no matter how far, you know, right it advanced. And so the strategy here is, it's bipartisan if you look at the big picture. The Republicans move things right, they take away all these social and civil liberties, and the Democrats, when elected, preserve just exactly where they are so that when the Republicans win again, they can move them further right.
Record inflation, another recession, a divided Congress, and no end to forever war. The Biden era can't be defined by just one crisis. A recent poll found that 60% of Democrats don't want Biden to run for re-election in 2024. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن می‌کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
Imam Khomeini's viewpoint on condition of leadership. Among the matters that the jurist should accept its responsibility is the enforcement of the Islamic Penal Code. The question here is that, is there a distinction among the Prophet Muhammad, the infallible imams, and the jurists so far as applying penal code is concerned? If jurist position is lower, should he pass a lighter sentence? Should the number of lashes received by an adulterer, adulteress, if judged by the noble prophet? Or it is the executive ruler who should have the responsibility of putting the divine penal code into effect, no matter whether he's the prophet, Imam Ali, his representative, or a judge in Basra or Kufa, or an Islamic jurist now?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, dear brothers and sisters. This is Ali, and we're going to talk about one of the statements of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh and Imam's viewpoints with regard to the government and the importance of the governments and the goals of the governments. In statement, Imam rahmatullah alayh says, if the people support a government, this government will not fall. if a nation supports a regime or a government that God